8:18 p.m. Working quickly, Tucker holstered his Browning and returned to the unconscious man. He slipped out of his own hooded parka and wrestled the man into a seated position. He then forced his coat over the man's torso, tugging the hood over his head. The man groaned blearily but didn't regain his senses. Straightening, Tucker hauled his limp body over a shoulder and carried the man to just inside the hatch, leaning him against the bulkhead. He took a step past him, then leaned forward, grabbed the ladder railing, and gave it a tug. The aluminum gave a satisfying squeak. Immediately he got a response. Clang, clang, clang. The grenade dropped, bounced off the last step, and rolled toward him. Twisting around, he vaulted over the seated man and dodged to the left of the hatch. The grenade exploded. More smoke blasted and shrapnel flew, finding a target in the man at the door. As the smoke rolled out, Tucker peeked around the hatch and kicked the macerated body deeper inside. It landed face first on the deck, coming to a bloody rest at the foot of the ladder. He backed out again. 5 seconds passed. 10 seconds. Felice was a hunter. He knew she would want to inspect her handiwork. At the first scuff of boot on metal rung, he signaled to Kane, and they both climbed the outside stairs to reach the open starboard wing of the bridge. Reaching the last step, he leaned forward and peered through the open hatch of the wheelhouse. It appeared empty. He pictured Felice on the ladder, abandoning the bridge to gloat over his body. Good. With the Browning up and ready, Tucker quietly stepped across the threshold into the wheelhouse. He slipped to the head of the ladder, took a breath, and pointed the Browning down the rungs. No Felice. No one. Just the corpse on the floor in a widening pool of blood. Kane growled at his side. On instinct alone, Tucker spun on his heel, jerked the Browning up, and fired as Felice stepped through the wheelhouse's port hatch. His sudden shot went slightly wide, catching the woman in the side just above her hip bone. She staggered backward and landed hard on the deck. Rushing forward, he reached the hatch in time to see her rifle rising. Don't, Tucker said, cradling the Browning in both hands, centered on her face. You're done. She lifted her head, her scarf fallen away, revealing the ruin of her handsome face. Part of her nose was gone, sewn with black suture, along with a corner of her upper lip, giving her a perpetual scowl. A thick bandage covered her left cheek. He recalled his last sight of her as she vanished into the icy waters. She had been found later, saved, but it seemed not before frostbite ravaged her. She snapped her rifle up, trying to take advantage of his momentary shock, but he also remembered feisty Elena and poor Utkin. It tempered any shock and revulsion. All he saw in the ruin of her face was justice. Holding steady, he squeezed the trigger and sent a single round through her forehead. Chapter 46. March 28th, 8:22 p.m. Grand Traverse Bay. From behind Tucker, boots clanked on the outside stairs. He turned and spotted a shotgun-wielding figure charging up the ladder toward the starboard wing. Here were the boots he had heard descending the ladder earlier. Not Felice. As the man reached the top stair, his shotgun up, Kane bounded into the hatchway before him, hackles raised, growling. The sudden materialization of the large dog knocked the man back, his shotgun barrel dropping toward Kane. Tucker shot once, placing a bullet through his sternum. The gunman tumbled backward down the ladder. Tucker followed him out, covering with his Browning, but the man lay on his back, snowflakes melting on his open eyes. Tucker took a fast accounting. He'd shot three men along with Felice, the same number as reported stealing the speedboat. But was that all of them? He waited a full minute more, but no other threat appeared. Satisfied, he moved farther out onto the bridge wing and cupped his hands around his mouth.
"Doc! Nick! Come forward quickly!"
As the two men joined him, running forward against the sleet and snow, Tucker peeled off the pressure bandage from his ear and called Kane to him as he knelt. He secured the bandage to the shepherd's wound and wrapped it snugly, patching his friend up as best he could for now. Bukalov joined him in the wheelhouse as he finished. The doctor's gaze shifted across the dead bodies.
"Is that all of them?"
"I think so. Time for you all to get to work. Take Kane and use his nose to sniff out which cargo holds might have been contaminated by Felice's team."
From an inner pocket of his jacket, Tucker removed a gauze sponge pre-scented with the sulfurous discharge from Bukalov's specimen of Luca. He held it to the shepherd's nose.
"Track and find."
He next turned to Nick.
"Go with them," he ordered. "Keep them safe."
"Will do."
The three took off, heading below decks. Remaining in the wheelhouse, Tucker crossed quickly to the computerized helm console. He hoped to find some way to turn the Makoma, to stop its collision course with the rocky coastline. Off in the distance, a light glowed through the snowfall. It had to be Old Mission Point, dead on the bow. Maybe 2 miles, probably a little less. He glanced at their speed on a gauge and calculated swiftly. 8 minutes to impact. Tucker studied the helm. Dozens of additional gauges, switches, knobs, and readouts spread across its console, but no wheel. Instead, he spotted a joystick with a hand grip. Beside it, an LED readout marking the ship's course. He grasped the stick and eased it slightly to the right, while keeping his eyes on the course readout. "Come on. Come on." The LED digits refused to change. Frustrated, he shoved the stick all the way to the right. But to no effect. The Makoma continued its relentless charge for the coast. The glow in the distance grew brighter.
"What am I doing wrong?"
Backing a step to consider his options, his boot crunched on something on the floor. He glanced down to find the deck beneath the console strewn with circuit boards, each one broken in half. Felice had sabotaged the helm. Even in death, she continued to thwart him. Kane suddenly appeared at the port bridge hatch, followed a half minute later by a panting Bukalov and Nick.
We found it, Bukalov declared. Or rather, Kane did. Remarkable nose on that fellow. They contaminated hold number 5, just behind us, but it's sealed like a bank vault. Looks like someone sabotaged the locking mechanism.
Felice.
Nick stared out the window, looking ill.
That's Old Mission Point, he confirmed. Dead ahead.
It's awful close, Bukalov said. If we crash before we can decontaminate that hold...
Luca would be let loose into the world.
8:27 p.m. After explaining his inability to turn or slow the ship, Tucker wasted a full precious minute as he scanned the helm, clenching his fist all the while. There had to be something. An override, an emergency shutdown. Where's a damned plug when you need to pull one? His eyes skipped over a gauge, then returned to it, reading it more carefully. Hold fire suppression. Tucker suddenly stiffened and swung to Nick and Bukalov.
Follow me!
He slid down the ladder, followed by the two men who scrambled after him. Kane used the outside stairs to join them below. At the bottom, Tucker grabbed the shotgun from the last man he had killed. Nick looked around.
What are we...
We need to find the crew, he said.
Why?
I'll explain later. Kane can help us.
Tucker searched the next few rooms on this level and found a crewman's cabin. He grabbed some dirty clothes from a hamper and placed it in front of Kane's muzzle, ruffling it to raise the scent and gain Kane's full attention.
"Track and find," he ordered again. The shepherd buried his nose in the garments, snuffling deeply. He finally backed a step, lifted his nose high in the air, then bounded through the door. The three men ran after him. Kane led them on a chase deeper into the ship's bowels, but in short order, the shepherd skidded to a double set of doors, sniffing furiously along the bottom. The door was labeled Crew Dining. Tucker pounded on it.
"Anybody there?"
Multiple voices shouted back, both frantic and relieved, overlapping one another. He tried the knob and found it locked.
"Move as far to your right as you can, and turn away from the door!"
After getting confirmation, he waved Bukalov and Nick farther down the hall along with Kane. He then pointed the shotgun at the door's hinges from about 6 inches away and turned his head. The blast stung his ears. He moved immediately to the second hinge and did the same. With his ears ringing, he kicked the door the rest of the way open. 7 or 8 crew members stood huddled together in the far corner. Felice must have rounded them up when Tucker arrived by helicopter, knowing her hopes of contaminating the cargo without anyone's knowledge were ruined. A tall, auburn-haired woman stepped from the group.
"Who are you? What's going on?"
"No time," Tucker said. "We're working with national security. Who's the engineer?"
A wiry man in a thick wool sweater and suspenders raised his hand.
"I am. John Harris."
"You're familiar with the ship's fire suppression system for the cargo holds?"
Tucker pictured the label on the helm's gauge. Hold fire suppression. Of course a cargo ship must be equipped with a sophisticated means of controlling fires, especially those that broke out in their cavernous holds. Fire was the ship's worst enemy.
"Yes, certainly," the ship's engineer confirmed. "It's a high-pressure water mist system."
"Where is it?"
"One deck down, right below us."
"Can you isolate hold number 5?
"Yes."
"Great. This is Dr. Bukalov. Take him to the fire suppression controls, then purge the water out of the tank and refill it with what the good doctor gives you. Can you do that?"
"Yes, but..."
He turned to Bukalov.
"Doc, do you have enough?"
"Yes, more than adequate, I believe."
"John, you've got your orders. Get moving."
As they set out, Tucker turned back to the other crew members.
"Who's the captain?"
The tall woman stepped forward again and introduced herself.
"Captain Maynard."
"Captain, the Makoma is going to run aground in about 3 minutes, and the helm console is locked. Where's the safest place on the ship?"
"At the stern, chart library, 1 deck below the navigation bridge."
"Go there now," he ordered.
As the crew filed past him, the last in line, a bald man wearing a cook's apron, suddenly wobbled into him. He was holding a bloody towel up to his mouth, and there was a deep gash in his forehead. Dried blood caked his eyebrows, nose, and mouth.
Tucker asked, "What happened to you?"
The man moaned and removed the towel to reveal a split lip and a flattened nose. More of Felice's handiwork.
"I'll get you medical help as soon as we can."
He turned to Nick.
"Help get this guy to safety."
Nick nodded and hooked the man around the shoulders, helping him move faster. The pair hurried after the others. Tucker turned and slid down the ladder to the next deck, following Bukalov and Harris, the ship's engineer. He found the pair standing before a wall console, with a panel open next to it. Bukalov's dispersal tank rested nearby, a hose running from it through the open panel.
"The fire suppression tanks are here,"
Bukalov said, as Tucker joined them.
"He just finished siphoning the kill switch into the right one."
Tucker checked his watch. 2 minutes. He asked Bukalov,
"Will this really work?"
"In an enclosed space like that hold? Without a doubt. That is assuming the fire suppression system works as described to me."
"It'll work," Harris said, and started pressing a series of buttons, then turned a lever clockwise. A button marked with the number 5 began flashing red on the board.
"It's ready."
"Punch it."
Harris stabbed it with his thumb. From the tank closet, a whoosh sounded, followed by a gurgling.
It's flowing, the engineer confirmed.
How long until it's empty?
It's high pressure, high volume. 45 seconds, and the compost in that hold will be soaked thoroughly.
Tucker clapped him on the shoulder.
Good job. Now we need to reach the chart library and join the others.
They scrambled up the ladder, where Tucker found Kane waiting. They took off as a group down the passageway with Harris leading the way. The deck began shivering beneath their feet. The engineer called over his shoulder,
"The keel's scraping the sandbar!"
"Keep running!"
At a sprint, Harris led them toward the stern, passing intersection after intersection. As they passed one, movement drew Tucker's attention to the right. For a fleeting second, he spotted a white-smocked figure sprint past, heading the opposite direction along a parallel corridor.
The man was wearing a backpack.
Tucker skidded to a stop, as did Kane. A backpack? Bukalov looked over his shoulder.
Tucker! Keep going. Go! Go!
The running figure in white had been the ship's cook. He was sure of it. But why? Tucker went momentarily dizzy as he fixed the man's broken visage before his mind's eye. Give him thick salt and pepper hair, a mustache, and clean the blood off his face.
General Harzin.
No, no, no. Tucker remembered the subterfuge back in Africa, when Harzin had sent in a body double to take his place. This time around, he had flipped that scam on its ear, disguising himself to look like an injured member of the crew. From the fact that the crew seemed to accept Harzin as their cook meant that the general must have assumed the role of ship's cook at some prior port, coming aboard under false pretenses in order to expedite Felice's team, to get them aboard unseen, to help them contaminate the hold, and likely to help get them back off the ship unseen. Clever. But once Tucker arrived and the gig was up, Felice must have beaten the man to further disguise his features. Harzin was the mission's final layer of security. If the ship was saved, he could still slip away with a final canister of Luca and wreak what damage he could. Tucker couldn't let that happen. He backtracked, turned left at the intersection, and took off after the fleeing man, with Kane. When he reached the parallel corridor, he stopped short and peeked around. There was no sign of Harzin, but somewhere forward a hatch banged against steel. He broke from cover and kept going. The deck gave a violent shake. He lost his balance and slammed against the bulkhead. As he righted himself, he heard faint footsteps pounding on aluminum steps. He pointed ahead.
"Seek sound."
Kane sprinted down the corridor, turned right at the next intersection, and down another corridor. It ended at a set of stairs heading toward the main deck. 10 feet from the stairs, a hatch door banged open far above. As he closed the distance, Tucker dropped to his knees and skidded forward with his shotgun raised. As his knees hit the bottom step, he blasted upward, just as Harzin's rear foot disappeared from the opening. The hatch banged shut. Tucker bounded up the steps, watching the locking wheel begin to spin. He hit the hatch before it fully engaged. He shouldered into it, bunching his legs and straining. Finally, it popped up, sending him sprawling outside onto his chest. Kane clambered next to him. Tucker pushed himself to his feet and looked around. To his left, General Harzin was running forward along the deck. Tucker shouted,
"Harzin!"
The man never looked back. He took off after the general. Then, suddenly, his feet flipped out from under him. He landed hard on his back. The deck bucked again, accompanied by the sound of steel scraping against sharp rocks. Tucker and Kane went flying. Chapter 47. March 28th, 8:30 p.m. Old Mission Point.
The Makoma's 900,000 pounds of iron and steel plow into the cold sands of Old Mission Point, its bow bulldozing trees, rocks, and bushes ahead of it. Debris crashes over the bow railing and smashes into the forecastle. 100 feet inland, the bow strikes a boulder off-center, heaving the ship onto its starboard side, dragging the forward third of its hull across a row of jagged rocks along the shoreline before finally lurching to a heavy stop. Tucker knew none of this. As the world became a Herculean roar of rent steel and churning rock, he recalled snatching hold of Kane's collar, of tucking the shepherd to his chest, and the pair of them tumbling over the Makoma's deck. They had bounced across the cargo hatches, pinballed off the davits, and slammed into the wheelhouse's bulkhead. They finally slid across the last of the canted deck and came to rest, entangled on the starboard railing. Christ almighty! With his head hammering, he forced open his eyes and found himself staring down into a well of blackness. He blinked several times, bringing the world into focus. A world of mud. He stared dazedly down through the starboard rails that had caught them as the ship rolled to its side. Below him rose a giant pile of black mud, its summit less than 7 feet under his nose. He smelled the ripeness of manure and the earthiness of rot. Compost. Kane licked Tucker's chin, the shepherd still sprawled half on top of him. The only thing keeping them from a plunge below were the struts of the rail.
"I got you, buddy," Tucker said. "Hang on."
Under him, the hull outside hold number 5, where Felice's team had introduced Luca, looked as though a giant had taken a pair of massive tin shears to the steel. Spilling from the gash was a massive wave of slurry compost, forming a mountain under him and spreading like dark lava across the landscape of Old Mission Point. 50 yards away, a wood sign jutted from the sludge. Lighthouse Park, Old Mission Point. A few yards past that marched a familiar figure, mucking calf-deep through the edge of the debris, a backpack hanging off one shoulder. Harzine. Tucker disentangled his left arm from the railing, reached across his body to Kane, and drew the shepherd more tightly to him. They had to find a way down, not that there was a way up. He saw only one possibility, a messy possibility. He stared below at the steep sloping mountain of wet compost.
"Hold on, buddy. It's going to be a bit of a drop."
Tucker shifted them to the edge of the railing and rolled off. As they fell, he clutched Kane tightly against his body. They hit hard, especially for landing in mud. Then they were tumbling down the slick surface of the mire. The smell filled his every sense. Muck soon covered them in a heavy coat. In a matter of a few moments, they rolled free of the compost mountain and out across a mix of snow and sand. Tucker stood up, weaving and unsteady. His left shoulder throbbed. Kane limped a few steps, his left rear leg tucked up against his body. But as his partner worked the kinks out of his muddy body, he brought the limb down and tentatively took a few hops. Sprained, perhaps, but not broken. Now, where was General Harzine? He was nowhere in sight. Kane limped forward, ready to go, but Tucker forced the shepherd down with a firm, "Stay." "You've done plenty, buddy." Tucker drew the Browning from its holster and edged forward, sticking to the deeper shadows of the Makoma's canted hull. Now out of the wind and snow, he could hear the pop and metallic groan of the dying ship. It loomed above him, like a building frozen in the process of collapsing. He noted a rope dangling from a railing ahead, marking Harzine's exit from the ship. The end hung a good 10 feet off the ground. He pictured Harzin dropping from it. Continuing onward, he climbed the bulldozed wave of sand and rock at the ship's bow. The tip of the ship hung like a massive shadowy hatchet in the storm overhead, waiting to fall. Tucker reached the crest of the stony tide and peered cautiously over its lip. 50 yards away, a figure moved through the storm, his back to Tucker and favoring one leg. Apparently, Harzin's descent hadn't gone any easier. The man slowly limped toward a snowy tree line, marked by park benches and gravel pathways. Tucker cautiously picked his way down the backside of the rocks and started stalking toward his target, not wanting to spook him. Whether Harzin heard his approach or not, the man suddenly shrugged off his backpack, knelt down near a copse of leafless maples, and unzipped the bag. A stainless steel tank shone brightly within the muddy pack. Harzin unscrewed the nozzle hose of the sprayer and tossed it away. Uh-oh. Tucker moved swiftly forward, incautiously snapping a twig. Harzin turned his head. The two of them locked eyes. Tucker raised his pistol and charged Harzin. The other swung around, shaking free the tank from the pack and hugging it to his chest like a shield. Harzin confronted him, dared him. Go ahead. Shoot. Hit the tank or hit me. It doesn't matter. Either way, the corruption inside will spill free upon your precious soil, and I'll have my revenge for my daughter. For my country. Tucker lowered the Browning and slowed his run to a walk. Off in the distance came the wail of sirens. The pair stood staring at each other, neither speaking. Tucker considered his options. First of all, he had no idea whether Bukalov had succeeded in decontaminating the ship's hold. He smelled the ripe sludge covering his body. The monster could already be out of the bag, set loose upon the shores of Lake Michigan. If so, the tank in Harzin's arms was irrelevant. Still, Tucker waited, wanting extra insurance for his next move. Then he heard it. Thump, thump, thump. Multiple helicopters echoed over the water behind him. Good enough. He shot Harzin in the right kneecap, breaking the stalemate. The man's leg buckled and he pitched forward. As he hit the ground, the canister knocked from his arms and rolled free. Yellow liquid spilled out of its open spigot, blazing a toxic trail, mapping its trajectory. As the tank came to a rest, it continued to leak weaponized Luka. Tucker moved forward, taking care not to step on any of the yellow lines. Harzin rolled onto his back, his face twisted with rage and pain. Behind him, a helicopter swept over the bulk of the Makoma, then hovered for a landing at a neighboring open stretch of beach. Others buzzed higher, circling wider, stirring through the storm. The cavalry has arrived, he said to Harzin. As the skids of the first helicopter touched the rocky beach, the side door popped open and a pair of men jumped out, both wearing anorak parkas and shouldering backpack sprayers. They should be able to quickly clean up and decontaminate the brief spill. Behind them followed another trio of men armed with assault rifles. The group began jogging toward Tucker's position. He returned his attention to Harzin. Do you see the men with the rifles? The general remained silent, his gaze burning with hatred. They're going to take you into custody, whisk you off somewhere for a long talk. But I'm not officially with them, you see. So, before they take you away, I want you to know something. Harzin's eyes narrowed, showing a glint of curiosity past the pain. You're going to need new shoes. He shot Harzin in the left foot, then right. Then turned away from the screaming and the blood. He'd had enough of both. Time to go home. He headed back to where he had left Kane. That was home enough for him. Chapter 48. April 7th, 10:43 a.m. Spitzkop Game Park, South Africa. Footsteps entered the barn. Now what? Laying on his back, Tucker scooted his roller board out from beneath the Range Rover. He wiped the oil from his hands onto his coverall, but there was nothing to do about the splatters on his face. No doubt about it, the Rover needed a new oil pan and gasket. As he rolled free of the bumper, he found himself staring up at the worried face of Christopher Nkomo.
"My friend," he said, "I am not comfortable accepting such a large gift."
Tucker sat up and climbed to his feet. Kane stirred from where he had been curled on a pile of straw, patiently waiting for his partner to realize he was not an auto mechanic. Tucker scratched at the bandage over his ear. The sutures had returned his ear to its proper place on his head and were due to come out now. It had been 10 days since the crash of the Makoma. It seemed Bukalov's kill switch had proved successful. The site declared Luka-free, although monitoring continued around the clock. The entire event was reported to the media as a mishap due to a fault in the ship's navigation systems during a severe winter storm. Additionally, the cordoning of the site was blamed on a hazardous spill. Under such a cover, it was easy for teams to move in with electric-powered dispersion sprayers and swamp the entire area with the kill switch as an extra precaution. It also explained the continued environmental monitoring. The rest of the crew, along with Bukalov, were discovered safe, except for a few broken bones and lacerations. Even Nick Pasternak, the pilot, was found with only an egg-sized knot behind his ear, where Harzin had clubbed him and made his attempted escape. In the end, with no one reported killed, the media interest in the crash quickly faded away into lottery numbers and celebrity weddings. Life moved on. And so did Tucker. 2 days after the events, he and Kane landed in Cape Town, bruised, battered, and stitched up. They both needed some rest, and Tucker knew just where he would find it. He waved Christopher toward the shaded veranda of a colonial-era mansion. The three-story sprawling home was located in a remote corner of the Spetskop Game Preserve, far from the tourist area of the park where he and the others had originally stayed with its bell captains and its servers dressed all in house whites. This mansion had been abandoned a decade ago, boarded up and forgotten, except by the snakes and other vermin, who had to be evicted once the restoration process began. A crew worked busily nearly around the clock. Ladders and scaffolding hid most of the slowly returning glory of the main house. New boards stood out against old, wide swaths of lawn, composed of indigenous buffalo grass, had already been rolled out and hemmed around the house, stretching a good half acre and heavily irrigated. Cans of paint were stacked on the porch, waiting to brighten the faded beauty of the old mansion. Farther out, the 20-acre parcel was dotted with barns and outbuildings, marking future renovation projects. But one pristine sign was already up at the gravel road leading here, its letters carved into the native ironwood and painted in brilliant shades of orange, white, and black. They spelled out the hopes and dreams for the Nkomo brothers. Luxury Safari Tours. Tucker crossed the damp lawn and climbed the newly whitewashed porch steps. Overhead, wired outlet boxes marked the future site of porch fans. Kane trotted up alongside him, seeking shade in his water bowl.
"Truly, Mr. Tucker, sir," Christopher pressed, mounting the steps as if he were climbing the gallows. "This is too large a gift."
"I had the funds, and quit calling it a gift. It's an investment, nothing more."
Upon completing the affair with Sigma, Tucker had noticed a sudden large uptick in his savings account held at a Cayman Island bank. The sudden largesse was not from Sigma, though that pay had been fair enough, but from Bogdan Fedosyev, the Russian industrialist whose life Tucker had saved back in Vladivostok. It seemed Fedosyev placed great stake in his own personal well-being and reflected that in the bonus he wired. Tucker took the same message to heart and extended a similar generosity to the Nakomo brothers, who, like Tucker with Fedosyev, had helped keep him alive. From talking to Christopher during the long stretches of the journey to the Groot Karas Mountains, he knew of the brothers' desire to purchase the mansion and the tract of land, to turn it into their own home and business. But they were short on funds, so he corrected that problem.
"We will pay you back when we can," Christopher promised.
Tucker knew it was an oath the young man would never break.
"But we must talk interest, perhaps."
"You are right. We should negotiate. I say 0%.
Christopher sighed, recognizing the futility of all this.
"Then we will always leave the presidential suite open for you and Kane."
Tucker craned his neck up toward the cracked joists, the apple-peel curls of old paint, the broken dormer windows. He cast Christopher a jaundiced eye. The young man smiled in the face of his doubt.
"A man must hope, must he not? One day, yes?"
"When the presidential suite is ready, you call me."
"I will certainly do that. But, my friend, when will you be leaving us? We will miss you."
"Considering the state of the rover, you may not be missing me anytime soon. Otherwise, I don't know."
And he liked it that way. He stared again at this old beauty rising out of the neglect. It gave him hope. He also liked the idea of having a place to lay his head among friends when needed. If not a home, then at least a way station. Kane finished drinking, water rolling from his jowls. His gaze turned, looking toward the horizon, a wistful look in his dark eyes.
"You and me both, buddy."
That was their true home. Together. Tucker's phone vibrated in his pocket. He pulled it out and answered, guessing who was calling.
"Harper, I hope this is a social call."
"You left in a hurry. Just wanted to check on you and Kane."
"We're doing fine."
"Glad to hear it. That means you might be up for some company."
Before Tucker could respond, a black Lincoln Town Car pulled into the dirt driveway, coasted forward, and came to a stop in front of the house. The engine shut off.
"I assume it's too late to object," Tucker said.
As answer, the driver's door popped open, and a woman in a dark blue skirt and white blouse exited. She was tall, with long legs, made longer as she stretched a bit on her toes, revealing the firm curve of her calves. She pushed a fall of blonde hair from her eyes, sweeping it back to reveal a tanned face with high cheekbones. Though he had never met the woman face to face, he knew her. Ruth Harper. He stood straighter, trying to balance the figure before him with the image formed in his mind from their many phone conversations. This certainly was no librarian. The only feature he got right was the pair of thick-rimmed rectangular eyeglasses perched on her nose. They gave her a studious, even sexier look. Definitely no librarian he had ever met. Tucker called down to her from the porch.
"In some lines of work, Harper, this would be considered an ambush."
She shrugged, looking not the least bit chagrined as she climbed the steps, carrying a small box in her palms.
"I called first. In the South, a lady does not show up on a gentleman's doorstep unannounced. It just isn't done."
"Why are you here?" he asked, though he could guess why, sensing the manipulation of her boss, Painter Crow.
"First," she said, "to tell you that Bukalov sends his regards, along with his thanks."
"He said the last part, Dr. Bukalov?"
She laughed, a rare sound from her.
"He's a new man, now that he has his own lab at Fort Detrick. I even saw him smile the other day."
"A minor miracle. How's he getting along?"
"His studies are still in the rudimentary stages right now.
Like with human stem cell research, it might take years, if not decades, to learn how to properly manipulate that unique genetic code to the benefit of mankind.
What about to the damage to mankind? What's the word out of Russia?
Through back channels, Harzin's superiors at the GRU have insisted they knew nothing about his actions. Whether it's true or not, we don't know. But word is that the Russian Defense Ministry is turning the GRU upside down, purging anyone associated with Harzin.
How about Harzin? Is he cooperating? She turned and balanced the small box she had been carrying onto the porch rail.
I don't know if you heard before you left, but he lost one of his feet. He must have rolled after you shot him, contaminating the wound with some of the spilled Luca organism. By the time anyone realized it, the only option was amputation.
Sorry to hear that, he lied.
As to cooperation, he knows the fate that would befall him if he ever did return to Russia, so he's grudgingly beginning to band, revealing small details to fill in some of the blanks, like revealing the name of a Port Authority agent who was paid to look the other way when and if the Macoma reached port in Chicago. The man's in custody now.
Good riddance.
And it seems Hazin's paranoia has finally proven of benefit. Prior to leaving for the States, he set up a failsafe at his lab outside of Kazan. Without an abort code from him personally every 24 hours, his lab's remaining samples of Luca would be automatically incinerated. He didn't want anyone else gaining access to them.
So they're all gone, then?
That's the consensus. His lab did indeed burn down, and if we're wrong, we're still the only ones who have the kill switch.
So it's over.
Until next time, she warned, arching an eyebrow. And speaking of next time...
No.
But you don't know...
No, he said more firmly, as if scolding a dog. She sighed.
It's true, then. You and the Nakomo brothers are going into some investment together? Luxury safari adventures?
As always, Harper, you're disturbingly well-informed.
Then I guess the only other reason I made this long trip was to deliver this.
She pointed to the box on the porch rail.
A small token of my appreciation.
Curiosity drew him forward. He fingered the top open, reached inside, and pulled out a coffee mug. He frowned at the strange gift, until he turned the cup and spotted the gnarled face of a bulldog on the front. The dog was wearing a red and white striped cap with a prominent G on it. He grinned as he recognized the mascot for the University of Georgia, remembering all of his past attempts at placing Harper's accent.
Never would have taken you for a fan of the Georgia Bulldogs, he said.
She reached down and scratched Kane behind an ear. I've always had a special place in my heart for dogs.
From the arch of her eyebrow, he suspected she wasn't only referring to the four-legged kind.
As to the other matter, she pressed, straightening up, you're sure?
Very sure.
As in forever?
Tucker considered this. Kane picked up his rubber Kong ball and dropped it at Tucker's feet. The shepherd lowered his front end, hind quarters high, and glanced with great urgency toward the endless stretch of cool grass. Tucker smiled, picked up the ball, and answered Harper's question.
For now, I have better things to do.
Author's note to listeners. Truth or fiction? As with my Sigma books, I thought I'd attempt here at the end of the story to draw that fine line between fact and fiction. I like to do this, if for no other reason than to offer a few breadcrumbs to those who might be interested in learning more about the science, history, or various locations tread by Tucker and Kane. But first, let's start with that illustrious duo. Military war dogs and their handlers. The first recorded use of war dogs goes back to 4000 BC, to the Egyptians, who used them in battle. But the modern use of dogs in the U.S. military really started in World War I. Since then, dogs have become an integral part of the U.S. military, including the dog Cairo, who was involved with the takedown of Osama bin Laden. During a USO tour of authors to Iraq and Kuwait, I got a chance to observe a few of these fighting teams in action. While in Baghdad, I also met a fellow veterinary classmate who was with the U.S. Veterinary Corps. He was able to give me great insight into the technology, the psychology, and even the aftermath of such a unique fighting team. All the MWD, military working dog technology found in this book, is real. From the Kevlar-reinforced K9 Storm tactical vest worn by Kane to his amazing communication gear. I also tried to capture that unique and intimate psychological connection between dog and handler, described as it runs down the lead, where over time the two learn to read each other's emotions and understand each other beyond gesture and spoken command. I also learned about how PTSD afflicts not only the soldier but also the dog, and how efforts are being undertaken to combat and treat both sufferers. As to Kane's amazing talent, that's also based on real stories. Even Kane's vocabulary, while stellar, has been demonstrated by a dog named Chaser, a border collie who has been shown to understand over 1,000 words, including grammatical structure. Last, after 3 decades of working with dogs as a veterinarian, I knew I wanted to portray these stalwart war heroes as they really are, not just as soldiers with 4 legs, but as real dogs. In this book, there are scenes written from Kane's perspective. Here, I wanted listeners to experience what it's like to be a war dog, to be in their paws, to paint an accurate portrayal of how a dog perceives the world, how he functions in combat with his unique talents and senses. I hope I did them justice. On to the central scientific concept and threat of the novel. Leuca and cyanobacteria. Leuca, last universal common ancestor, is a scientific concept concerning the origin of life, the proverbial seed from which all life sprang. There are many different theories about how that ancient life form might have presented itself, whether its origin is rooted in DNA or RNA, whether it needs extreme heat to survive, or moderate temperatures. It remains a great unknown. In regard to the concepts of cyanobacteria as a progenitor for modern plants, all the science and details regarding this ubiquitous form of life are true, including that you can find cyanobacteria in every environmental niche on the planet, including the fur of sloths. The threat of invasive species. This is a real and ongoing threat across the globe, where foreign species invade an established ecosystem and wreak great harm. From the introduction of pythons in the Everglades, where those snakes are creating untold damage, to Asian carp in the Mississippi, which are wiping out native fish populations and sweeping toward the Great Lakes. Such threats have not escaped the notice of federal counterterrorism officials. Alarm bells are being raised that terrorists could very well use invasive species as biological weapons, where the introduction of a single virulent organism into an environment could cause great economic and physical harm. Possibly, irreversibly so. Let's move on to the main history topics. The Boer Wars. All the details of this bloody conflict are true, including the military tactics related in the prologue and the weapons used, like the Krog. The character General Manny Roosa was very loosely based on the real-life Boer leader Manny Maritz, and you can still find such pocket camps of the Boers hidden throughout South Africa, and the archaeological ruins of their forts still dot the countryside. Arzamas 16. The Russians did indeed have closed science cities called Naukagrads, including one named Arzamas 16, which was home to the Soviets' first nuclear weapons design. The U.S. intelligence community did indeed refer to it as the Russian Los Alamos. Last, location, location, location. One of the great thrills of writing is being able to shine a light on various regions of the world, and the kill switch was no exception. Grant and I strove to make sure every detail of each location was as accurate and illuminating as possible, from life in Siberian villages to the historical magnitude of the Kazan Kremlin. Even such details like the submarine eco-tours of the Volga River are factual. I also wanted to paint an accurate picture of South Africa, its wildlife, and the regional strife of Namibia, while capturing the raw beauty of the Groot Karas Mountains. Over the course of writing this book, I grew to love these places, and I hope you enjoyed the journey too. Finally, let me leave you with one last fact. Tucker and Kane will be back, because their true adventure is just beginning. This is Scott Aiello. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Kill Switch, a Tucker Wayne novel, by James Rollins and Grant Blackwood. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2014 by James Chakowski and Grant Blackwood. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.